session number 17729, reel 3.
Bill Kalbrick, reel 3.
In the ARP, being a cadet, after serving 5 years in an actual semi-army unit, as a cadet unit, we were attached to the local territorial battalion. Consequently, all of our instructors were permanent staff instructors, so they were regulars. So we were well grounded insofar as rifle drill. We used to go to Alka for firing the rifles. General deportment, everything from top to bottom that would make a good soldier. So after 5 years in the cadets, when the war first started, my immediate reaction was to get into something. And of course, the ARP, and the fact when I went along in uniform, the fact that I was a corporal at that time, and when the war started, I was touching nearly 18 years of age. So I was brought in as a group messenger boy over so many messengers. But my idea was to formulate these messengers from about 26 sector posts all over Liverpool 8 to the group headquarters, which was then in off High Park Street, the corner of High Park Street and Admiral Street. But after 3 months as group messenger, I was made head messenger for Liverpool under a chap called Bennett Hamley, which I've said before, and that was looking after all the messengers throughout the whole of Liverpool, and that was to ensure that the various letters and things were taken by bicycle. And a lot of the messengers during the air raids, the bombing raids, were on the bicycles taking messages in between sector posts and down to the headquarters of the cadets at that of the ARP at that time. Was in the air shaft buildings, which was just by the Mersey Docks and Harbour Board. I stayed in that until I joined the Home Guard. And then I've already said this once before, that eventually joined an anti-tank platoon and was made a corporal within about 3 months of joining the Home Guard. And my father was in the Home Guard at the same time, so I knew my dad was a private in the Home Guard. Bit of a lash-up because on my father's chest was the First World War ribbons, whereas, really speaking, I was a lad of about 18 and 19, a corporal in the Home Guard telling veterans what to do, which was a bit naughty, really. And then I was glad when the RAF, I was called off the RAF.
When you heard Chamberlain's war declaration, how did you feel about it?
I don't really know, because when they played Drake's Drum, as I said before, I came out expecting guns to be fired and anything else. It was during the phony war. There was nothing. Nothing happened. The fact they declared war, we had our soldiers in France and so on and so forth. I don't think I thought that way. I don't think I thought about soldiers, about RAF. I don't think I felt any way at all. I came out my grandmother's house, and that was around about a quarter past 11. On the Sunday, it happened on a Sunday. The Sunday was no different than any other Sunday. The people were still going about the business. Going to the cinemas weren't open, funny enough, then. When the war was declared, they closed the cinemas for a time and the theatres until eventually they sorted themselves out and reopened again. But life was no different. The only difference was that on that Sunday, in UK, prior to the war, Sunday was as dead as a dodo. There was no cinemas, there was no theatres. If you belonged to a club, it was all right. I used to belong with a gang of lads who knocked around Liverpool late. Consequently, all we ever did was knock around together, go into the local Jewish herbalist and have fizzy drinks there. No mention ever going into a pub in those, not of our age, it wasn't even considered. So, whereas when war was declared, you're expecting this and expecting that, it didn't happen. Life went on normally until they brought out all the regulations insofar as the lights on the car, if you had one, the lights in the street, the lights in your houses, and it wasn't in the ready speaking, I should say it's about 1940 that you started to notice the change and the various restrictions brought in. And I think the first time you saw the policeman on duty outside, the original police station was in Essex Street, but that was C Division, and that was moved down to the domestic mission, where the policeman on duty outside had a steel helmet on, and everywhere was sandbagged. The idea of the sandbags was to stop anti-shrapnel and stop the blast, the bombs and all that. It was so unreal because nothing was happening. And people were saying, well, let's get it over and so on. We knew our lads were in France and all that business. The only thing we relied on in those days was the radio. Television didn't exist. So whatever came over across the radio was gospel, because that's the only news you could get. Unless the Liverpool Echo, it's called Liverpool Express in those days, they came out with all kinds of editions, especially if there was a special edition or something had gone wrong during the war, they'd come around with a placard in front selling these papers. And lots of the time it was another way of enhancing their circulation. But a lot of the times there was some shocking news to be had, you know, and I think we paid half pence for a paper and so on and so forth. That's the only way we got news. And it was only when the bombing raid started that we realised the goodness of the sandbags and the various things they'd brought in and keeping the lights down. But when you saw the bombers coming over Mill Street, well, they weren't necessarily coming over Mill Street. From the air, they covered a wide area. But you could see them up above you. And you never knew where they were going to drop the bombs. And it didn't follow that if you watched them at that height, you'd see the bombs come out the bomb doors, because that would be an impossibility. Because eventually they used to come down with such speed, and they'd drop, and you'd know that a bomb had dropped.
Mm. Now, coming on to your being called up to the RAF, did you say it was in late 1940?
Well, I joined in 1940. I went to RAF at Central Hall, which was a recruiting set in Renshaw Street. And eventually I went up to Padgate where I was given a medical examination. I was giving a written examination. I told them I wanted to be a wireless operator air gunner. I couldn't be a pilot or nothing like that because my education qualifications, I left school when I was 14. Then I went to night school for 2 or 3 years, because in the trade I was in, it was essential that you went to night school. So I knew the elements of trigonometry, and I was always good at maths. My English was abysmal, quite honestly. My writing was terrible. I think my best subjects was geography, history, but maths, we didn't call them maths in those days, we called it arithmetic. And I've always been that way inclined on maths and figures and so on and so forth. So my potential was to be a wireless operator air gunner. That was it. And I was put on deferred service, which they issued me with a small silver badge with a pair of silver wings on. And it said RAF deferred service. And I wore that in my lapel. Eventually, I went up to the RAF around about May or June 1941, when I went to Blackpool, which was the recruits training. Plus the fact that I'd done Morse code. Morse code was at the tram sheds at Squires Gate in Blackpool. And over night time, I used to go over night time to the signal school. The idea was that once I could do up to 5 words a minute, I'd go to this night school where I would do 7 or 8 words, which I couldn't do. But at least I got used to the speed. So when I went to the proper signal school, the RAF, it was the same for night time. But when I went the next day, well, the fact I couldn't take eight words a minute, I could say 6 words quite easily and so on and so forth. But after a certain amount of time, I found out that I started quite a lot of it because the Morse code was pushed down your throat. You'd done your drill and you'd done kinds of other things as well. With the wireless, you went in round about, say, 9 o'clock in the morning and came out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then you go home into your billet and get what you had to eat and go to night school. So it was continuous. And I found out I couldn't cope with the situation, and I started to get some sores around the mouth, which was an irritation of nerves. And I'd heard, and I came off the course altogether. And I was sent on a drill instructor's course. When I was at Blackpool, within the fifth week at Blackpool, because of my cadet service again, they were looking for acting corporals to look after the squads. The squad consisted of 45 men, of 60 men in 60 men in fours, when in threes then, 15 fours, and they running short of corporals because at Blackpool, I reckon there was about 5,000 or 6,000 men. There was an air commodore commanding it, two or three group captains, and then we were on a certain wing with a wing commander. And there was an inspection at one time, and the inspection officer was a squadron leader, or the wing commander, and he wanted somebody to have a rifle in the hand, to come to attention, to salute him, give them that kind of thing, to walk up, give them this, give them that, to go back, and then to do the drill with a rifle. Well, I'd done all that with the cadets. It was second nature from top to bottom. And he asked me various questions, but the rifle stuck in my hand, and he asked me to do certain things, and then to clear the rifle, and how to put the ammunition in, and all that. Well, I knew it. I knew the lot. It wasn't a case I picked it up with the RAF. I hadn't. I already knew it. And I was made acting corporal. I think I was acting corporal for about a month. The only advantage is you didn't get any extra pay, but if you wanted to go home for the weekend, you were never stopped by the SPs at Kirkham. And eventually I was posted to Filey, RAF Filey. Now, RAF Filey was Butland's holiday camp, which was a shambles, which was only on the park construction. There was more than clay, and all the chalets were right on the cliffs itself, with no heating in, hardly any lighting. Oh, it was a right old mess, thick with mud. And I completed the drill course there, and eventually passed out as a corporal. And whilst I was there, I heard they were looking for straight air gunners. Just, you know, that's the only job you've done as air gunner. And I put my name down and was accepted. And then I was told I could put the white flash back in my hat, in my forage cap. If you were air crew, UT, under training, you had a white flash. And the first station I was posted to, from there, was RAF Sealand. And they didn't need a drill instructor, but they attached me to an SI flight, which was a special installation on bow fighters. That was an aerial in the nose that more or less could tell over what land you were going over, the terrain and all that business. And the flight I went to was a Canadian flight, but there was an English officer commanding it, and that was a flight lieutenant Fennessy, who came from Southport, eventually became a squadron leader. And I was attached to that flight, and the Canadians there used to get the cigarettes. I didn't smoke, of course, but all kinds of extra rations and all that. Now then, in July, my aircrew training hadn't come through. I was still waiting for it to come through. And there was a big push in Egypt, so they were sending as much RAF they could out there in 1943 and everything. I was posted overseas to Egypt. And I was given 14 days embarkation leave. So I came home and I was engaged to my wife, that was called Ivy. She died about 30 and a half years ago. And my mother got together with her mother, and my aunts and my uncles all got together, and we decided we'd get married. We'd have a white wedding. Photographs and there. We got married on the 11th of July, 1943. And had a great time. And on a Sunday, we were together, and on a Monday, went back to RAF Sealand. And I was told then that the the station adjutant wanted to see me. Now, a station adjutant on a place like Sealand, it was a big maintenance unit, but it also had an EFTS, Elementary Flying Service, with tiger moths. And I went to the adjutant, and I was certain amounts of trepidation going to see him, because, you know, he's quite a big bloke at that time. Went in, he said, congratulations on your wedding, Kelbrick, and all that kind of thing, and I stood attention, stand at ease and all that. So I've got good news and I've got bad news for you. What do you want first? I said, well, I had them both. So he said, well, anyway, the bad news is you're not going overseas. I said, I've just got married. They think I'm going overseas. They told me. He said, no, you'll have to go and tell them, won't you? I said, well, why aren't you going overseas, sir? And all this, he said, well, your aircrew training's coming through. Within 6 weeks, you'll be gone from the station. So I had to come home and explain to my wife, who was only then, when I'd been married, less than 48 hours, 72 hours, that I wasn't going overseas. And eventually I went down to St John's Wood, London, ACRC, where you'd done all your dental tests, your medical tests. You had to blow through a mercury tube and hold the mercury up for over a minute and keep your breath in and all this kind of carry on. Where you'd done aptitudes tests insofar as trigonometry and all kinds of other things. We were in private flats. There was two flight lieutenants running it, and they were sods of the first order. If you were late, you were taken off the course. If you'd done anything wrong, you were taken off the course. And I remember going to the dentist on a Saturday evening and been in the dentist for 2.5 hours, where all of the fillings were done and all that business, and then walking down London. We were only, I was only an AC1 then. We left there eventually, and I went to Bridlington, which is my ITW, where we were kitted out with complete flying kit and kept in a kit bag, and it was a novelty of going around it with the flying this, that. We were far removed from aeroplanes at Bridlington, I can assure you. It was right on the seafront. They had dancers every Saturday night, and the food dispersed, and they didn't get a lot of food, I must admit. We just got enough to keep us going. I went there for 6 weeks when we'd done trigonometry and elementary navigation and all wind finding and velocity of the bullets and how it went and the trailer pursuit and all that kind of carry on. Now, when I was there, and I should have gone from there to my air gunnery school, but there was a bottleneck in flying training. They'd had a bad winter and so on and so forth. So we were kept back another 6 weeks, which was the best thing ever because I'd done an extra gunnery course, which helped me later on. Eventually, I was posted to RAF Morpeth, which is outside Newcastle, which was number 4 air gunnery school. And when we arrived there, there'd been a smash, a mid-air smash. The aircraft there were called Bothers. It was a high-wing, twin-engine monoplane. They were terrible. They were outrageous. They were underpowered and everything else.
What were they called?
Bothers, B-O-T-H-A, or Bother, Bothers. terrifying aircraft they were. They'd been with the Fleet Air Arm, and when they used to launch the torpedo, they used to go starboard into the drink. So when we got there, there was 3 aircraft that crashed together for some unknown reason, and there were 16 Dutch air gunners killed. They were up there. So we started the course, and then after 6 weeks, we passed out, and I was a sergeant air gunner with a brevio. And it was on a Good Friday of 1943, and I was sent home for 72 hours. Now, the 72 hours included the Friday. In those days, by train for Newcastle, it was going from the ends of the earth. We left the station at 11 o'clock on the Friday morning and eventually arrived in Lime Street Station in Liverpool at 1:45 the next morning. Absolutely unbelievable. Came home, and I was married then, and that was 1943. My wife was working with the ROF on munitions at Long Lane, exactly. Went down to see my mum and dad and all that business. And on the Monday, I got the train from Western Lions, which is at Birkenhead, and I was posted to RAF Upper Hayford, where we crewed up. Wonderful station, absolutely marvellous, all air crew, all kinds of things. During the time I was there, the crew were all going into Banbury one night. There were 7, but by that time, the pilot had already got the navigator and the bomb aimer, and got one of the gunners, and the night came on board, and the wireless operator was there, and the flight engineer. We never got the flight engineer. We didn't get him until we got to Swinderby, to the conversion unit. They all were going to Banbury that night. Now, I didn't drink, and I didn't smoke, and so on, and it wasn't one for... it was all new to me completely. Bit of a loner in those days, it was really. And I was asked would I be the duty air gunner. They said, don't worry about it, you get extra food, you get some free drinks at the bar, which was immaterial, but but you'll be well looked after. There's no chance you've been cut. Nothing will happen. So don't worry about it, Kelly. Don't worry about it then.
Kelly?
I was called Kelly by my crew, Kelly. My skipper, if he was upset with me, he would call me Kelly, but it was called Kelly eventually. Just got a letter from him from Australia. He's an Australian, or Kel. And at 6:15, the tannoy went, well, Sergeant Kelbrick reports to base operations. Well, I went up to base operations, and the warrant officer pilot there, and the radio operator, wireless operator air gunner. And they said, we're going on a square search. A dinghy had come down in the channel, and we went within 2 miles of the coast of France. I was in the rear turret then, because there's only one turret in the Wellington, that's the rear gunner's position. And he was up front, and the wireless operator, and for some unknown reason, the heating wouldn't go in the Wellington, so it was freezing. And the wireless operator wasn't well. Something happened to the wireless operator. He wasn't well. And the pilot, we eventually found the dinghy. We found it within the 2 miles of the coast of France, and we radioed back. And then we eventually, we done another search. We sent all the information back to our group headquarters, whatever it was. And they alerted Air Sea Rescue. And on the way back, he took me out of the rear turret, and I sat up next to him. And all I did for him then, when he reset the course, I reset his compass, that kind of carry-on, you know. We had the flask of coffee and some biscuits and some sandwiches. got back around about 12:45 in the morning. The skipper and the rest of the crew had come back and couldn't find me, and all this kind of carry-on. And made inquiries and found out I'd gone on this dinghy search and so on. And then after Upper Hayford, we went up to, my skipper went to Swinderby, which was a conversion unit from Wellington's onto Manchester's, which was a twin engine version of the Lancaster, but it was underpowered, it was a hopeless bloody thing. And eventually onto Lancaster's. And I went to RAF Fulbeck to do a fighter affiliation in a Wellington again as a rear gunner. And the aircraft had done all this evasion and all that. That was a wonderful situation. And after Swinderby, we were there about... we converted onto Lancaster's. Now, Morton Hall was just across the road from Swinderby, and that was the headquarters of Five Group. But it was also the escape course. All aircraft had to do an escape course. The escape course is that they gave the impression that you were coming down in France. You'd fly off... You were taken in lorries, darkened lorries. You weren't allowed to see where you were going, and dropped in the dead of night in countryside. Now, on the particular one that I was on this night, there was Americans with us, and they took it for granted. They broke into a pub and out themselves and all this kind of carry-on, you know. But you had to make your way back. But the Home Guard were alerted that there were German paratroopers down, and also you were in your RAF battle dress. They picked you up, they took you prisoner and all that kind of carry-on, you know. They were told that the chaps, the Germans who were down were in RAF aircrew uniform, and it was very authentic, the whole thing. It was really done that course. And then from there, I was posted to 50 Squadron with the crew in July 1943, where we done some training flights. And at that time, the skipper had to do a second dickey on a Lancaster over Germany. Now, can I get to my first raid, please?
Where was this squadron base?
Skellingthorpe, a satellite station. You see, in Bomber Command consisted of about 6 or 7 groups. There were 2 group, 3 group, 4 group, 5 group, 6 group, 7 group, and so on. The group I was in was Lancaster's. The group was commanded by an Air Vice Marshal, that's equivalent of a Major General or a Rear Admiral. The chap we had was a chap, the Honourable Ralph Cochrane. And then, to each group, there were four bases, and each base was commanded by an air commodore. The base station had a permanent group captain, and they had 2 satellite stations. Now, at our base station was 53 base at Waddington with an air commodore, Hesketh, CBE DFC, And they had wing commander operations and wing commander engineering and so on and so forth. But there were two squadrons there, 463 and 467 at Waddington, which were Australian squadrons. At Bardney was 9 squadron, which eventually I went on Tiger Force to. And on my station it was only 50 squadron, but eventually they were joined by 61 squadron. And we turned up there in July. And then on the 15th of August, 45, we flew off to, we went on our first operation, and that was Milan, over the Alps, a wonderful sight. over the target, my ammunition became jammed, and I took my gloves off, and just got some frostbite on the tips of my finger. But we came back from there. The trip lasted a total of 8 hours altogether. We didn't do any more ops.
How much opposition was there over that target?
Well, there was a few Italian fighters, but there was hardly anything. there was hardly any flak, really, at all. I think the worst part about the trip was going over France and over the Alps itself and all that business. I noticed a lot of the aircraft had the starboard and port lights on, which, really speaking, you're not supposed to have because it's identification. And we got back from the 8 hours altogether it took.
Why did they have their lights on?
Well, there was no opposition, you know, going over the Alps and all that kind of thing. You wanted every possible thing you could find. I don't know why they had the lights on. They never had the lights on in our aircraft. For all the world, it was just like going on a trip to Milan. We'd heard so many stories about the Italian Air Force and about the Italian defences and all this kind of carry on. And the
what kind of story?
Well, to the effect that there was hardly any opposition. And there wasn't. There wasn't. We lost out of our squadron, we didn't lose any aircraft. But in the group, I think we lost about 5 aircraft on that raid. But that wasn't through enemy action. That was from all kinds of things. You know, going over the Dolomites and all those type of things. That's where you went over. And quite honestly, it was some of the chaps had come too low and all this kind of carry on, you know. But there was no real opposition. And then the that was on the, I think that was the 15th of August, wasn't it?
Yes.
And then on the 22nd of August, we were sent to Cologne. And that operation took over 5 hours. There was nothing to report on that particular trip. And then within 1 day, we came back on the 23rd, and we were on ops again. And it was the big city, which was terrifying. The name of the place, Berlin, you know, enough to make have the diarrhea or something like it. And so we went to Berlin, and that was our first trip ever over the big city. And I think we all had a lot of misgiving when we saw the target. You know, insofar as the aircrew briefing, the air gunners went into a separate briefing, the flight engineers went into a separate briefing, the wireless operator air guns went into a separate briefing, the bomb aimers went into a separate briefing, but the pilot navigator went into the main...